KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the hour, Democrats in the Senate are going to lose the seat vacated by Joe Manchin in West Virginia. Can they hold on to all the others in November? John Nichols has our analysis, starting with Maryland, where Democrat Angela Alsobrooks will face a popular Republican who is a moderate, in quotation marks. But first, for today's political update, we turn to Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's editor-at-large of The American Prospect. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
Today's first topic, Joe Biden in the working class. That New York Times Siena national poll recently showed Biden's level of support among non-college voters of all races is down to 39%. That's 9 points less than his level of support from those same voters in the 2020 election. If he's going to win, he's got to close most of that gap between now and November. Working class voters constitute a disproportionately large share of the electorate in three crucial swing states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Biden won all of them in 2020. Hillary lost all of them in 2016. And now Biden's numbers with working class voters are back to where Hillary's were. What is to be done? Harold, you've been studying the recent polling. The issues that working class voters care about are not very mysterious. Tell us about them.
No, they're not mysterious. And I should add that all of the numbers that you cited come from a poll conducted by a very reputable Democratic pollster, Celinda Lake. Not surprisingly, economic issues top the concerns of those working class voters in those states. And they include maybe above all the solvency of Social Security and Medicare.
A tax on the 1% on not paying its fair share, how significant could that be as an issue?
That could be very significant. That's an issue that the Democrats have owned for a long time. And if you sort of separate out the sort of the Democratic base issues from how Biden is doing in terms of maybe taxing the 1%, raising minimum wage, providing affordable childcare, all of that polls very well. Clearly, though, the issues that, in the three states that you mentioned, where there is in some ways a working class that's got a lot of workers closer to retirement than is the case in other states, affirming the Democrats' historic commitment to Social Security and Medicare is a big part of it.
I asked a person who works in this field, what about the issue of protecting American democracy as something that the working class should care about? And what I was told is, well, a lot of them will tell you it hasn't worked very well for us for the last decade or two.
To sound like a Marxist for a second, this is a problem of late capitalism and all the imperfections that go with a very unequal market economy and the stratospheric levels of inequality eroding what most people in the working class and the middle class and generally most people think of as a real cog in the wheels of democracy, a real subversion of the all persons are created equal creed, which underpins democracy. So yeah, and that has led not just to the ascent of a populist right in this country, but in much of Europe as well.
So the idea that the working class responds to political appeals based on economic populism, this is not a mystery to us. It's not a mystery to Joe Biden. He talks about this every time he goes out on the stump, pretty much. So the big problem for Biden is not that he doesn't know what the issues are and that he doesn't talk about them. He does know and he does talk about them. That's the easy part of the 2024 election. What's the hard part?
Well, there's one hard part in this a study that I wrote about on Monday, and there's another hard part that I deal with in something I wrote for Thursday, which is yet to appear as we record this on Wednesday late afternoon. What I wrote on Monday was the importance of social networks, the importance of your peer groups in sort of helping both plant ideas in your political consciousness and sort of reaffirming the validity of what you think politically. And what the study points out is much the same thing that a book I've talked about on this broadcast before, Rust Belt Union Blues, makes, which is to say, any form of a sort of more progressive peer group has in any institutional way disappeared from the lives of working class Americans with the disappearance of unions. The study that was put out Monday, not only by Celinda Lake, but by some other groups, including groups, one of them headed by Steve Rosenthal, who was a great political director for the AFL-CIO under John Sweeney. What these groups are trying to do is to construct this kind of working class peer group in terms of neighborhood activists in working class neighborhoods, particularly in the states that you mentioned. But again, in the absence of unions, which have sort of fallen away and are no longer present, largely because of business opposition and Republican suppression, they're just not there. So it's an uphill struggle to create the kind of social networks that would reinforce the importance of progressive populism and link it to Biden rather than Trump.
So the lesson here is working class people, in fact, probably most voters, don't change their minds based on TV ads, and they're not really keyed into last minute appeals to get out the vote in the week before Election Day. In fact, maybe even a majority of voters don't vote on the basis of comparing the issue positions of the two candidates on the things they care about. People vote the way their neighbors vote. They vote the way their friends and their family vote. They vote the way their groups have been voting for the last several elections. And there is a logic behind this often, but it's not directly keyed to the issues. It's keyed to the social networks. And what you have found is that the structure of social networks has been transformed large in working class America, largely because of the decline of unions.
That's true, but there's another factor too. And The Guardian had a poll on Wednesday conducted by the Harris poll asking people what they thought about the economy. Now, that we all know that everyone thinks inflation is out of control. And when we say inflation, what most people mean is the prices of food, sometimes the price of gas, sometimes the level of rent. And those are, you know, really difficult. But the conclusions drawn from this, and this poll makes clear, are really sobering. They ask Americans, are we in a recession? 57% of Americans said yes.
Wow.
49% of Democrats said yes.
Wow.
They asked, is this the highest level of unemployment we've seen in 50 years, and a majority said yes. Actually, of course, it is the lowest level of unemployment we have seen in more than half a century. So something is seriously screwed up, and it's partly the social network, but I think it's also the decline of sort of curated media and people's radar screen, and the rise of social media, which tends to accentuate the negative and has been no friend of Biden. And it is also, I think that there's a reciprocal relationship between people's ridiculously negative view of the economy. Because when the economy's been much worse, polls have shown people still think it's better than they think it is now. So, but there's a reciprocal relationship between these conclusions about the economy and people, and particularly working class, hesitancy or outright opposition to Biden, since it's viewed as Biden's economy. And I think the one thing that would make people's view of the economy better, actually, in my calculation, is if they think better of Joe Biden. Similarly, if for some reason they think the economy is much better than what they told the Harris pollsters, I think that will increase Joe Biden's prospects. I think given where Biden is now, one of the very few ways he can do that is to have a really stellar debate performance. And I think this is one reason why his campaign agreed to have a debate as early as next month in June with Donald Trump, because there's such a confusion of day with night in these polls on the economy that it really reflects, I think, this failure of both Biden and fact reporting media to really make an impression on what has been dubbed the vibe session that we are going through. And breaking the vibe session is difficult, both because of the reason we discussed a few minutes ago. Your peer group has no one in it who's willing to necessarily challenge the vibe session if you're in certainly a white working class community, or not nearly enough people who'll do that. And the Biden failure to establish really the image of himself, not only as a progressive populist president, but as a successful progressive populist president. He's a much better president than he is a candidate. And that's what the Democrats face, unless he can turn that around.
And there's one other piece of evidence that underlines your conclusions. The same poll that shows Biden behind in the swing states, what does it show about the Democratic Senate candidates in the swing states?
They're ahead. In Wisconsin, Tammy Baldwin in Nevada, Jackie Rosen, Ruben Gallego in Arizona, and there's a fourth, which is
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania with Bob Casey. They're all ahead. They're all ahead. And so, you know, there's this old it may derive from the Yiddish, as many things do, that the fish thinks from the head. In this case, it's the head and the head alone, which is most endangered. And that is Biden. But there's still support for, you know, basic democratic programs like supporting Social Security, like supporting affordable child care and so on, like supporting student loan forgiveness. That initial poll I talked about from Celinda Lake made clear that even with this working class community, which is supposedly clearly comes out as anti-Biden, they're still majority in favor of the student loan thing and the affordable child care thing and paid sick days. So it's not the Democratic program, and it's not the down ticket Democrats. It's the up ticket Democrat. Have I depressed you sufficiently?
It is a mixed picture, since the Senate candidates are doing well, like they should be doing. You know, one conclusion is, well, how do you change people's minds in the, 5 months that are left here? Since it's the social networks, the one thing that people respond to is face-to-face contact with other working-class people like themselves, which means send out UAW members, Unite Here members, you know, the culinary workers in Nevada. They should be doing the door-to-door work, talking to people about their own lives and why they might vote for a Democrat. And I have to say, it's a lot better to send out union members than to send out college students to do the door-to-door work.
Absolutely. The college students should do their own campuses, where there's going to be significant pushback to Biden anyway. So that's where the college students need to be. And the culinary union in Las Vegas has a lot of work to do, because on the one hand, while the Democratic incumbent Senator Jackie Rosen has a lead, Joe Biden is trailing Donald Trump in Nevada by almost double digits, if not actual double digits. There's a lot on the plate of the hotel workers in Vegas if Nevada is going to swing back at the presidential level and hold on at the senatorial level to the Democratic column.
So we also have to talk about the other grim news of the week, the UAW defeat at Mercedes in Tuscaloosa last week. It's a story we've been talking about for a couple of months here. 2,000 workers at Mercedes in Tuscaloosa voted in favor of affiliating with the UAW, 2,600 against, course, this came after that string of victories for the new union leadership, which culminated, as we celebrated here, in that strong vote at VW in Chattanooga. We expected the UAW to win at Mercedes in Tuscaloosa, so that this was a big defeat. What's your analysis? How did Mercedes management defeat the UAW in Tuscaloosa?
Well, Mercedes management was a good deal more aggressive than Volkswagen management, and I think that made a real difference. Volkswagen, you know, all German corporations have to have boards of directors that are divided 50-50 between the shareholders' representatives and the workers' representatives. Volkswagen is an exception because it was actually founded by Adolf Hitler. The Allied powers after World War II said, well, we got to do even more at Volkswagen. So the workers plus the government, the state, the province of Germany where Volkswagen is headquartered, the government of that province plus the workers actually have a majority on the Volkswagen board. And Volkswagen pretty much didn't really campaign against very heartily against the UAW for the election in Chattanooga. The elected officials, the elected officials of Tennessee, all of them Republicans, certainly did. But that didn't make a difference. The difference at Mercedes, however, is that management did actively campaign. First, they gave carrots. They got rid of the old head of U.S. Mercedes operations and brought in a new head just 2 weeks before the election. And that led to immediate raises and the elimination of bottom tiers on the pay scale of Mercedes workers. And in a sense, that is the the bitter victory of UAW, that they really forced better working conditions and better pay on the Mercedes workers, even though they themselves were not elected as the representatives of those workers. And then Mercedes held these captive audience meetings in which they compel all employees to attend these essentially anti-union diatribes delivered by management, which always have an effect and which is in the standard playbook of corporate anti-union campaigns. Such was not really the case at Volkswagen.
At The Nation magazine, Jane McAlevey wrote about the lessons of Mercedes and how to run a stronger campaign next time. She's been on this show many times. Her big strategy, which she has used as an organizer in nurses' strikes, is organizing not just the workers, but community members, getting political officials, getting ministers and priests to support the union openly and publicly at rallies, getting leaders of community groups, getting celebrities to come. The striking thing is that the Mercedes did some of this. Of course, they had all the political leaders, the Republicans. They also brought a famous football coach, and the union, Jane McAlevey argues in The Nation, needs to do a much better job of organizing a broad base of community leaders and well-known people to publicly support the organizing. I wonder how important you think that could be.
Well, clearly it always helps. Now, in Alabama, you're in a political terrain where essentially you can get Black elected officials and Black ministers to come out in support of the union. Finding white elected officials and white ministers in Alabama is, it's not quite a needle in a haystack, but it's does have some resemblances to that. So, you know, for that reason, the South, by Jane McAlevey's criteria, is a pretty tough road to hoe.
So the UAW is not giving up. They're going to keep working at Mercedes, and after that, there's the Japanese and the Korean car makers, which are going to be even tougher, it seems like. But UAW knows about this, and they're going back to work on organizing. We have just enough time for your Minnesota moment. That's news from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sean Hannity. Trump came to St. Paul last week. He spoke at a Republican dinner. He said Joe Biden was, quote, a horrible human being and a non-athlete, and made fun of his golf game. He also said he had won the state in 2020, fact, he lost by more than 7 points, and he said that he would carry Minnesota this November. The last time a Republican presidential candidate carried Minnesota was 1972. I'm sure you remember Richard Nixon. That was 52 years ago. I wonder if you have any comment on Biden devoting some campaign time to Minnesota.
There's a finite number of states that are locked down. I don't think Minnesota is quite locked down, but you know, it's not in the category of the three states we talked about earlier. It's not that much of a swing state. And purely on Biden as an athlete versus Trump as an athlete, you know, I think advantage Biden. I'll give Trump this. He can ride in a golf cart as well as just about anyone.
Harold Meyerson, read him at prospect.org. Harold, thanks once again for your insights into American politics.
Any questions you have about golf carts, just ask me, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. It's not going to be easy for the Democrats to hold on to control of the Senate in the November elections. They now have a 51-49 majority, but they are defending seats in states that Trump won 4 years ago. For our analysis, we turn to John Nichols. Of course, he's national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of many books. Most recently, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism, co-authored by Bernie Sanders. We reached him today in Barcelona. John, welcome back.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, John.
Well, the Democrats are expecting to lose that Joe Manchin seat in West Virginia. It's the most pro-Trump state in the country. That takes us down to a 50-50 split in the Senate. And now Republicans are hoping to take a second Democratic seat in the blue state of Maryland, where they are running the popular former Republican governor, Larry Hoagland. But let's start with the Democratic candidate in Maryland, who won what we thought was going to be a close primary, Angela Alsobrooks. Tell us about Angela Alsobrooks and her victory.
Well, she's a remarkable candidate, and she's somebody who, you know, has come up the political ladder by hard work. She's been an aide to political figures and then was elected as effectively a county executive in one of the major counties in Maryland. And what happened with this Senate seat was that when it opened up, you saw a lot of very powerful, very nationally known figures consider running for the seat. And then what they all backed off because there was a super rich guy, an owner of Total Wines, who was running. The feeling was that he was going to buy the seat, basically, that he was going to spend so much money in the race that everybody else decided it's not worth making a try. Alsobrooks decided that she would make the try, and she built a real grassroots campaign. She got outspent almost 10 to 1. Wow. I want to emphasize that. Almost 10 to 1.
Incredible.
Outspent, right? And so what she had was her personality, which is very strong. She's just a very effective politician. And then she had a lot of support because she's well-liked in Maryland politics. People like Jamie Raskin and others backed her. But at the start of the race, I don't think a lot of people thought she was going to come through. And her opponent stumbled at a number of turns. He proved to be not as effective a candidate as should be, is often the case when you have a lot of money. End result is that she won kind of a landslide, very big victory in the primary. And now she is headed into that general election with Hogan.
Maryland hasn't elected a Republican senator since 1980. That's 44 years ago. How, with Trump at the top of the ticket, could they hope to win that seat in a blue state this year? Please explain who Larry Hogan is and why he's a serious threat in a reliably blue state.
Larry Hogan is a multi-generational Maryland political figure. His dad was in politics. He got in as a relatively, you know, kind of a middle-aged guy, ran for governor and got elected as a moderate Republican. The Maryland Democrats have had a lot of problems over the years, a lot of internal fights and squabbles. He took advantage of that. He got himself elected governor, and he served a couple terms. By most accounts, he was a popular governor. He not only won, but then got himself reelected. That doesn't mean he's any kind of liberal. He wasn't. He was actually some social issues. He's rather conservative. But at the end of the day, he came away with a pretty good impression. He left the governorship a couple years ago, and he was a very anti-Trump Republican. So he made noises about running against Trump in the Republican primaries, or perhaps about running as an independent candidate for president. So he really presented himself as sort of an anti-Trump kind of figure. But then here's the interesting twist on it, John. When the National Republican Party, this is Mitch McConnell and his crowd, when they came knocking, Larry Hogan suddenly became a Republican loyalist again. He said, yeah, I'll be your candidate for the U.S. Senate from Maryland. They said, well, great. You do get good poll numbers. We're going to pour money into you. We're going to really, we're going to make you a top tier candidate. And so that's what's happened here. They have set Hogan up as, supposedly somebody who, is more of an independent minded guy. And it is true, as governor, he served as a somewhat more independent minded figure. But the thing to understand about Larry Hogan and why this is going to be a complicated race, two big issues. Number one, if he is elected, his first vote will be to give Republicans control of the U.S. Senate. And so it doesn't matter where he may stand on a particular issue. At the end of the day, he gives Republicans, and if by some chance Trump was elected president, Trump, effective control of the Senate. So that's a scary thing right off the bat. And the second thing is, his record on abortion rights, which is such a critical issue this year, is actually quite weak.
So in the Maryland Senate race, we have a popular Republican moderate, given the present Republican landscape.
Yeah, let's put some quotes around that word. Yeah.
Quotes. A white man who's already been elected governor and reelected, running against a black woman who has not held statewide office. That has to be a challenge for the Democrats. What is Angela Alsobrooks' strategy? How can she win?
Well, her strategy is to do exactly what she did in the primary, and that is to run as herself. A smart, able manager, good stance on the issues, who's willing to campaign really hard, go to the grassroots, knock on doors, do everything she has to do. So that's the kind of campaign strategy side. She's a very hard worker and a very effective campaigner. But then she's got an issue, and her issue is going to be abortion rights. And the fact of the matter is that as governor, Hogan blocked funding for education programs about reproductive rights. And then when that funding was passed over his veto, he then refused to allocate the money. And so they've got some good fodder for a campaign that distinguishes Ashbrooks, or Alsobrooks, who is a very strong supporter of abortion rights, with Hogan, who claims to be a supporter of abortion rights, but actually has a very shaky record.
So let's talk about some of the other states where Democratic senators are running for re-election in toss-up states. New York Times last week published a poll that shows Democrats ahead in four key swing states. Nevada, Jackie Rosen, incumbent Democrat, 40%, Sam Brown, 38%. And in Nevada, they're going to have an abortion rights referendum on the ballot. It seems almost certain, though twice as many signatures as required were submitted, I think, last week. That will definitely help that Democratic turnout in Nevada. Arizona, Ruben Gallego polls at 45%, Carrie Lake 41%. This is that Kirsten Sinema seat. Democrats won it 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And 2 years ago, Carrie Lake lost the governor's race. Remind us who Carrie Lake is.
She is somebody who, if she wasn't running for the Senate seat, would be a front runner to be Donald Trump's vice presidential running mate. She is an incredibly right-wing figure, former TV personality. She's a very good campaigner, very effective on the stump. But the thing to understand her is that she takes stands that makes Trump look mainstream. She is extremely combative, and she still has not accepted the results of the gubernatorial election she lost 2 years ago. But now she's running for U.S. Senate. She is probably one of the most MAGA figures in the MAGA Republican Party.
In short, Carrie Lake is good news for the Democrats and Ruben Gallego in Arizona. Arizona also has an abortion rights referendum that has qualified for the ballot that will boost Democratic turnout there. The other two states that the New York Times polled were Pennsylvania, Bob Casey, incumbent Democrat, 46%, David McCormick, his challenger, 41%. And in Wisconsin, Tammy Baldwin, way ahead, 49%. Who's the guy who's running against her?
A guy named Hubde, H-O-B-D-E. And Mr. Hubde is a very interesting character. You know, he's born and raised in Wisconsin, so given that. But he has spent most of his adult life outside of Wisconsin, living in Washington, and now for many, many years, living in California, where he's a very prominent banker. He does TV ads in California, wearing a cowboy hat as a, you know, kind of likable banker. And so suddenly he decided to, I know that's a hard thing to imagine, but he suddenly decided to come back to Wisconsin. And I got to tell you, you know, John, I live in Wisconsin.
Yes.
And I can just sum this up. He's running a really weird campaign. One of his first campaign moments, if you will, was a point where he broke some ice and then sat down in the ice, you know, in the frozen water, and said that people should vote for him because he was doing a real Wisconsin thing, sitting in a frozen lake. And basically every Wisconsinite I know said, I never did that. So he's kind of a weird character, to say the least.
So Wisconsin, we're not too worried about Tammy Baldwin being reelected.
Well, she would tell you to worry, because she's that Tammy Baldwin's never lost an election campaign. And the reason she's never lost is she takes everyone very, very seriously.
Probably the toughest state for Democrats, if not Maryland, is Montana, where the incumbent Democrat John Tester, who's been reelected twice, is being challenged by Tim Sheehy, endorsed by Trump. Tester describes him as an out-of-state multimillionaire from the Minneapolis suburbs. Doesn't sound that bad to me, but I guess in Montana, this is a black mark against you. The latest polls show them nearly even. Sheehy has this interesting problem. He got shot in the arm. He originally said it was fighting in Afghanistan, but it has come to light that he also has said he accidentally shot himself in the arm in a parking lot in Glacier National Park. This is a story that's hard to forget.
Look, you know how we mentioned just about Hubde, that he had spent an awful lot of time in California?
Yeah.
You know, she has spent a lot of time in places other than Montana, including Minnesota, which I know in your mind makes him very, very qualified. But a lot of Montanans, listeners should know that John's got roots in Minnesota, but a lot of Montanans don't really see that as an argument for electing someone. Here's the challenge in Montana, and it's a big challenge. Montana's a state that will probably give Trump a 20-point advantage this year. And so as a result, Tester has to make up a lot of ground. He's got to get a lot of people to vote who voted for Trump to vote for him. And that's not very easy, because Tester's actually been a pretty mainstream Democratic senator, a little bit more conservative on guns and some things like that, but generally pretty much voting with the party. The thing that Tester's got going for him is he's deeply rooted in Montana. He's very, very closely related to Montana values. He's a farmer, a working farmer. And so he's got a good argument for himself. He has also beaten the odds again and again and again. And so as a result, I think he's competitive, but this is one the Democrats are going to be watching right up through Election Day. This one, and also Ohio with Sherrod Brown.
Yeah, let's talk about Ohio. That's probably the race that we care about the most. Sherrod Brown, hero of the working class, again, reelected twice in a state that voted for Trump twice. The guy challenging him this time is Bernie Moreno, a self-financing candidate who's basically a car dealer. One poll in March had Sherrod Brown comfortably ahead. Bernie Moreno is a wealthy immigrant from Colombia, endorsed by Trump.
Look, here's the bottom line. Moreno, he is running as a very conservative candidate. He, in the past, wasn't as conservative. You know, this is part of the function of what's happened within the Republican Party, more Trump than Trump. And that's what he's trying to be. He's got Trump's backing, and in Ohio, that's going to count for a lot. where I was saying in Montana that Tester has to make up about a 20-point difference. You know, he's got to get a lot of those Trump voters to vote for him. In Ohio, it's probably an 8 to 10-point difference. Still, looking like a pretty good state for Trump. The main thing that Brown is going to have to do is reach across those lines of partisanship to some of those folks who may be inclined to vote for Trump, but to say to him, look, one of the reasons you may be inclined to vote for Trump, and remember, Brown is somebody who's opposed Trump on just about every turn, is because you're concerned about your jobs. You're concerned about economics. Well, there's nobody in Ohio politics who's worked harder to defend Ohio jobs, particularly manufacturing jobs, than Sherrod Brown. And so he's got a pretty good argument for people to, you know, stick with him. These are candidates who've beaten the odds in the past. They have won in years where their party sometimes struggled. And so, you know, my sense with Brown is that he can pull this off. There's no one in the Senate, no one who has been more devoted to, you know, kind of what he refers to as the dignity of work, this concept that people who work 40 hours a week ought to get a good salary, ought to have good benefits, ought to be cared for, you know, be treated decently. He's passionately pro-union, very parallel in many senses to Bernie Sanders on a host of issues.
One last thing. Any chance for a Democratic pickup? Is there one Republican seat Democrats might be able to win? How about Texas, Ted Cruz?
Yes.
He's being challenged by Representative Colin Allred, who is quite a substantial candidate. Tell us about that race.
There's no question that Allred is competitive because, you know, remember, Cruz, nobody likes Ted Cruz.
Nobody likes it.
In fact, literally, there are Republicans who have said, you know, I think I'm probably Ted Cruz's best friend in the Senate and I hate him.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like the guy has a real problem. However, Texas is an incredibly Republican state still. It's moving more toward the Democrats, but it isn't there yet. And so that's going to be a tough race. There's no question. So Texas is a competitive state. I would also say keep an eye on Florida. Florida has an abortion rights referendum on the ballot. They've got a Senate race. Rick Scott's up. He's got a credible Democratic opponent. There's a possibility there. And then also keep an eye on Missouri. Missouri also looks like it's going to have an abortion rights referendum. And, you know, Lucas Kuntz, who's the Democratic candidate there, is a really impressive candidate going up against Josh Hawley. And so when I look across the map, I think there are a number of places where Democrats have the potential for a pickup. But the thing is, this is a problem because Democrats are going to be spending so much of their time and energy defending incumbents. It's a question of, can they get the energy out there? Can they get the resources to go after a pickup? The Democrats have been dealt the toughest hand you could as regards Senate races. So they got to be looking for any place that they could pick something up.
John Nichols, read him at thenation.com. John, thanks for talking with us today.
It's a great honor to be with you, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Now it's time to talk with Margot Jefferson about her new book, Constructing a Nervous System, a Memoir. Her earlier memoir, Negroland, won the National Book Critics Circle Award in 2016. We talked about it here, about growing up in Chicago in a world of black respectability and then going to college in the Black Power era. Before that book, she had won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism for her work as book and arts critic for the New York Times. And she's also written for The Nation magazine. Margot Jefferson, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to return.
Well, you wrote in Negroland, that's the world in which you grew up, that one of its foundational principles was you don't tell your secrets to strangers, certainly not secrets that expose error, weakness, failure. Seems like with this new book, you have left Negroland forever. Right at the beginning, you're already telling us about your workaday monster. This is a stunning passage where your monster tells you that you are a coward in work and love, and that it's time to blame your dead parents, but that to do that, you must be nuanced. You must be literary. What was it like to write those parts, to tell secrets about weakness and failure to strangers, to violate your parents' principles?
Well, you know, I had done some violating in Negroland. My father had died by the time I started writing Negroland, but my mother's feelings were mixed. She would supply me with stories and anecdotes, and you know, so a part of her, the waggish literary part, was very interested in all of this. So I thought, I will take these liberties, but in any case, here I am, alone in the world, in that way, an orphan who's an adult. It was difficult, but it was exciting, because once you identify, name something you call a monster, you know, you've entered non-realistic territory, and your imagination gives your emotions license. You know, so I thought, all right, and it's a code, you know, it's a series of metaphors, so it's fine. And the thing that I suppose I still dread about self-revelation is self-satisfaction, exonerating yourself somehow by some means or another when nobody else gets exonerated or excused. And I wrote that, and I tried to write it, and I think I did, in a way that pointed the ironies, the tiny little self-indulgent hypocrisies, but necessities also, emotional necessities, that pointed them out and made them into a story, you know, a dialogue, a scene. And, you know, that old trope of the second self, you know, which the monster is in a way, it's amazing how flexible and fluid that one still is.
Well, most of the book is not about your monster. There's many exhilarating parts, like you and your sister doing Ike and Tina. It's 1961. You were 13. Were you Ike or were you Tina?
Well, I was both the Iketts initially, and then I really had to step in and be Ike. My sister was claiming Tina. So I had to work with that as best I could. All of us were thrilled by their music, and every girl, you know, was enraptured by Tina. But since she claimed her, you know, I had to, you know, like an actor with maybe a lesser part, I had to do what I could, and I ended up getting left with this unexpected interest, you know, continuing lifelong interest in the chilly killer mysteries of Ike Turner.
On the other hand, Ella Fitzgerald. We have to talk about Ella Fitzgerald. Her singing was perfect, but there was something about Ella that bothered you, the way in which she was not perfect.
Exactly. You know, I, of course, first heard her, as everyone of my generation did, when I was a girl. And the records were dreamy, and my parents spoke about them, and that voice is enchanting. But as a little girl in the 50s and, you know, into the 60s, I was craving, you know, questing for glamour, for irreproachable, flawless glamour. I think all girls of all races and ethnicities were. There was a particular intensity if you were Black or another person of color, because, you know, you were not sanctioned as a potentially beautiful, desirable creature by the larger culture. So, you know, the investment, for example, in Lena Horne, who was accepted, you know, as an icon of culture, was huge. So Ella threw me off. She was well-spoken, she dressed well, but she was a hefty matron. And the sweat, she was the only woman I ever saw on television. Working so hard and so openly that sweat dripped down her face. Working class labor, I associated sweat with, and manliness. You know? What it says now, of course, is I brook no interference with my needs as a musician. You know? but it rattled me. I was very involved in manners and proprieties, at least their surfaces. And, you know, very anxious about what you violated and what the cost was.
Her greatest album was Ella in Berlin, 1960, which ends with her incredible performance of How High the Moon, song from the 40s, Somewhere There's Music. This super fast scat singing of hers draws on quotes from, you discovered 45 other songs, including to the tune of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. She sings Sweat Gets in My Eyes. Ella drawing on 45 other songs in 6 minutes of singing is a little bit like what you do in this book.
Oh, don't I wish. But you know, let's say it became a kind of model, at least for me. That's right. The reaching out, the almost excessiveness, and then, you know, the bringing it in to shape it and structure it. Yeah. Well, that's very nice. I love that. I guess it was a model. Isn't it funny that I haven't thought of it in that way when that chapter is so obsessed, you know, with Ella? But yeah.
Then we get to Bing Crosby, one of the whitest and one of the least sweaty people on earth. Mr. White Christmas, you call him. The most shocking sentence in your book is, "I'm Bing Crosby." Why?
You know, there again, it's a little bit like Ike Turner. There's always a mystery to these non-licensed obsessions. But I must also add, one of the things that intrigued me, first of all, there's a kind of triumphant, traditional, mainstream, nothing is disturbing, you know, the rules and regulations and myths of American culture, utter power, white male power, uninhibited, uninterrupted, not having to labor, you know, to assert itself, being very cool. And that spectacle was fascinating. The other thing, though, that intrigued me, which Gary Giddens, of course, explores so well in his Bing Crosby work, he had begun as a pop jazz singer who worshipped Louis Armstrong and Big Spider Beck and Ethel Waters. And you can hear, you know, again, it's that sense of the double and triple personalities. You hear that in the early work, you know, with the Paul Whiteman band, with the, quote, rhythm boys. Then you watch these transformations, you know, into Dear Hearts and Gentle People, into the Bob Hope movies, into a frightening kind of Mr. America. But that he could get away with all of it is what fascinated me. And that's what made me feel that it was in my version of claiming the license that a minstrel has. You put on that mask because they have something you want, but you drop it when it's over. You know, it's presuming. It's presuming. So I wanted to reverse that power dynamic.
One of my favorite moments in the book comes when you're in eighth grade, 1960, when you see West Side Story, the stage play, with Cheetah Rivera singing, "I Want to Live in America." You write, "Latins are a deluxe signifier for Negroes on stage and screen, an alluring, enviable addition of non-white people with histories not wholly bound to the history of slavery in the United States." What a great sentence.
Well, thank you. You know, and also with a range of looks that allowed them, you know, the lighter skin sometimes, the straighter hair, you know, the, "Well, I'm Mexican." Nah, not that, now, that's been turned into, by certain right-wing quarters, an insult. But in the old days, you know, that was somewhere. It still had a place in the culture. The same was true if you think of, and which I think I did write about in Negroland, Flower Drum Song. For example, the same, and The King and I, Asians could occupy that same role from the point of view of Blacks in those movies. You know, a limited, controlled, and contained glamour, but glamour.
Can we talk about Black feminist anger modes? What you call your muses, your coaches, and your exemplars, which I guess starts with Nina Simone. You say, "My friends and I were besotted with Nina Simone." You call her works in the 70s an oracle of our collective grief and fury. Wow.
She was. And actually, interestingly enough, for male listeners too, You know, she really claimed that grief and fury, having begun always with that extraordinary voice and power, but having begun much more in the kind of jazz American popular song mode. Those first, you know, that first album, you know, her versions of I Loves You Porgy or Mood Indigo, but always that intensity that implied I'm controlling this song. You know, the song is not controlling me or offering me a vehicle to be enchanting. I'm controlling it. I'm interpreting it. I'm crafting it with my persona. And then, you know, she did move into this really almost epic political god and goddess-like presence. We didn't know at the time that she was. Now we do. At the same time, you know, suffering hugely emotionally, bipolar, etc., which makes her to me all the more impressive, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. With an edge of tragedy because of all that pressure placed on her to be, as a radical, even as a Black radical, exemplary, as had been pressed on her when she was more a jazz performer, but astonishing, you know, one of a kind.
But you decide that you prefer for yourself what you call the counter diva mode, where anger uses comic brevity. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, we work with our limitations as well as our advantages. So I recognize, particularly from my very early days dabbling in acting, you know, that I do better with certain modes of aggressive reserve and underplaying something rather than overplaying it. So, you know, one studies that. And that whole chapter of female anger, which actually starts with adolescent, you know, modes, you know, it really is all about how you make your way through all of these feminine styles, some blatantly angry, very few in the early days, some very with angry subterfuge, you know, and you adapt what you can for your own circumstances, you know, and also for your own aesthetics, you know, with my sister as it was Martha Graham, you know, she was a modern dancer, but you know, when she saw Martha Graham pull a red cloth out of what were her innards to simulate Medea, you know, where else could you achieve that kind of power? You know, you internalize those things. And every movie of Betty Davis is for the same reason. Even when Betty lost, her style won out and her will won out.
At the very end of your book, you describe a meeting you attended of a group called Black Women for Wages for Housework. This is in the 70s. You quote a speaker who says, "I'm tired. I'm tired for what my grandmama did." And you wrote in your diary that you were disdainful about what you called wearing the garb of ancestral suffering. This was 40-some years ago. What do you think about that today?
I see what I was saying. I didn't want to, and it was something a lot of feminists and Black feminists in particular were examining. You know, how do we do justice to history without claiming that suffering and moving ahead with it, almost as if it were a theatrical, you know, garment to wear? I think I was harsh on that young woman, but I see what I was grappling with in myself. Because I then go on to talk about my grandmother and the power and the pressure exerted by that power of the figure of the Black grandmother, you know, who can do everything and who represents all that is noble but also was oppressive in that, in your history. So you are constantly feeling you must live up to that.
It's just a really moving part of your book.
Partly because I adored my grandmother, you know, so that combination of rapture and intimidation with an authority figure is an authority figure who has personal authority, but also has historical authority. That is formidable as a formative influence.
So you have a wonderful list, which is actually a description of how your parents' world regarded Black popular culture. But I think it also applies to you in this book. You have used, honored, disdained, studied, learned from, borrowed from, stolen from, been inspired by, gone slumming in, this huge list of books and movies of music. It's the first book I know of to bring Willa Cather next to Ike Turner, and you overcame the voice that said, you can't do that. So all I can say to that is, wow, and thank you.
Let me just add that Willa and Ike are not in the same chapter. They inhabit this larger landscape of the same book. And yes, that passage you read, I believe that, I was writing, I think, in that passage, as you say, about our relations to Black culture, but it's also what I'm doing with white culture, isn't it?
Margo Jefferson's new book is Constructing a Nervous System, a Memoir. Margo, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
We spoke with Margo Jefferson about her memoir, Constructing a Nervous System, in April 2022. The book was listed as a best book of the year by the New York Times, Time Magazine, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, many other places. It's out now in paperback. That's it for Living in the USA for today. Our producer and social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Our audio editor is Alan Minsky. Thanks as always to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at applepodcast.com, Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.